This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, we tour a big game preserve outside of Devil's Lake. But first, most moms can tell you how much their babies weighed at birth. Minot's Melissa Olson is no exception, in part because it's not the kind of weight any mother would want for their baby. Baby Natalie was born at 28 weeks, tipping the scales at barely more than 2 pounds. If you're a baker, you probably use that much butter every Christmas for cookies. Olson certainly uses that much butter and more in her at-home business honoring the late Natalie. 9 sticks of butter cookies. Melissa, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for being here.
And here is in a home where you are running a business. What made you want to start this business from your home?
It's a funny story. I was following a YouTube star for kids called Blippi because my kids like them. And so I was following him on Instagram so that I could, you know, keep up with new videos that were coming out and stuff like that. And Blippi himself reposted a picture of some birthday cookies someone had made. And I saw them and I thought, oh my goodness, how cool are they? I started looking through all of these and I kept, it was like a rabbit hole. I just kept looking at all these cookies thinking, you know what? I bet I could do this because I've always been artistic and I've made cakes before and cupcakes. And so I knew I could do something like that. So I just decided to try it out. And 3 years later, here I am.
When you say artistic, were you always drawing, painting? Did you study art in school?
I've never studied anything. I've never taken any classes for anything. I'm just kind of an artistic mind. Creative, I guess. And I always have been, but I haven't really done anything formally. And so I just enjoyed the artistic side of life, but I'm not an artist. I'm just a cookie artist.
Edible art, I feel like, is like the highest form, frankly.
Well, you know what I really love about edible art is that I can make it, give it to someone, and they eat it, and it's gone. You know, I don't have to hang it up and hope someone buys it. It's someone wants it, they buy it, and it's gone. And, you know, it's in demand, so I don't have to worry about that.
Well, and there's something, too, to that idea of appreciating art in the moment. They have those sand art pieces, you know, or where you put flower petals down and you make something with the express purpose of appreciating it for that moment.
Right.
And then it's gone.
That's right. And I think a lot of people, well, I get a lot of, I could never eat those cookies. They're too pretty to eat. And I always say, well, just look at it and then eat it because they're delicious too, you know? So you can always order more.
Is it a recipe that you developed?
No, actually, the first recipe I found on Pinterest for the cookie is the one that I've used. You need a no-spread cookie so when they bake, they have nice sharp edges so that, you know, they hold their form. And I found a recipe that I really loved. The royal icing that I use is a recipe that, again, I found from a cookier. I've loved it. Royal icing tends to get really hard and crunchy. The type that I use has some corn syrup in it, so it makes it a little softer and more pliable. So,
how much of that did you know going in, that just idea of how to change the medium and how that will impact the finished product?
I really didn't know anything. I just jumped in. And the great thing about this is that I've just learned as I've gone. And if you look at my first cookies to my cookies now, obviously they've changed a lot over the past few years. But it's so much fun learning from others. And there are so many other women out there like me out all across the world, actually. And, you know, with the internet and with Instagram and Facebook, you can connect with all of these people and learn from them and get ideas from them and be inspired. So that's what I've learned.
What is your process for how to decorate these cookies?
It's the royal icing. So royal icing, you make your royal icing and then it comes, it's like a marshmallow fluff when you've made it. And you have to have different consistencies. You do like an outline. And then you flood it with a runnier form of the royal icing. So you add water to the royal icing to make it runnier and to fill in the little areas. So for the florals, you have to have really thick icing, and for the rest, you have to have thin. So it takes a long time. I usually make 2 to 4 dozen per order, typically 2 dozen. And those would take anywhere from 6 to 12 hours to make for just the 2 dozen. It depends on the detail and stuff like that, but you really need to make things, let things dry. It always takes longer than I think too, but you can't speed it up.
Are you able to charge what you're really worth?
No. You know, I've raised my prices, and some people can't afford it, and I understand that. But some people can, and my time is worth money. If you're putting 6 to 12 hours of work into cookies and you charge $80 for them, for the 2 dozen, that really doesn't work out to a whole lot. And so if I, you know, charge $10 an hour, that would be super expensive. You know, to me, it's more than about the money. I only take so many orders because I just want to be creative. And it's nice that someone will buy my creativity.
What's the reaction from the customers typically?
Amazement, usually. And I'm so humbled by that. It never ceases to amaze me how people are so blown away by them. And it's nice to have something that you feel like you can really do well. And that's one of them for me. And so,
for a lot of people, any kind of artistic process, whether it's painting or playing guitar, baking, they talk about the meditative quality. Is it a time of kind of meditation, a time where your mind can kind of go where it needs to go?
Oh, for sure. Right now, my kids are in school, but I have one at home. And so I really can't do everything during the day. So I end up doing this at 2 a.m., 3 a.m. You know, it ends up being that because you have to be focused on it while you're doing it. You can't stop and start. You have to, once you start it, you got to keep with it. So I end up doing it late at night when it's very quiet. And I really enjoy the quiet time for me to do something that I really love. And so I do, a lot of times I just sit in silence and think and pray and do whatever I would, you know, I'm missing out on during the day. And then the other times I just binge watch stuff or just listen to podcasts, you know, just to keep me from falling asleep.
Why is it called 9 Sticks of Butter?
We have a daughter who was born in 2006. She was born at 28 weeks, and so she was a little tiny baby. She was 2 pounds, 4 ounces, and one of the first things her grandpa said was, oh, that's 9 sticks of butter, because that's how his mind works, and he just said that. So over the years, we've used 9 sticks of butter as, you know, on the memory albums of her, that's how much she weighed, because that was just kind of a way you could imagine how tiny she was only 9 sticks of butter. When I started this business, I said, you know, I don't want flour in the name. And there are a lot of different names that have been used, a lot, sugar or flour. I just didn't want anything like that. But I wanted it something unique and something personal. Well, our daughter, she had cerebral palsy, and she was confined to a wheelchair. And 4 years ago, she passed away in her sleep. We're not quite sure what happened, but she lived a great life and she was inspiring to a lot of people. And so we're just happy that we had the time together. But, you know, I was trying to find something after she passed away that would be something for me, because for those 10 years, I was dedicated only to her, and that was my mission, and it was my best mission. But I needed something to fill that void. And so I think this has kind of filled that void. And so my sister-in-law said, why don't you call 9 sticks of butter? So that's kind of a tribute to her. This is my way of, you know, doing something that, you know, it's not her, but it's something to fill the time for.
Do you feel Natalie here with you ever?
Oh, for sure. All the time. I mean, I talk to her at all times. So, I mean, she's just kind of part of our lives, and we talk about her and pray with her with the kids. And so she's just a huge part of our lives, and she always will be. We're moving out of the house that she was raised in, but a lot of wonderful memories here. But, you know, our family is growing, and it'll give me opportunities for this business, too, to do a little bit more. So,
how do you talk to your other kids about Natalie?
Well, they were here when she passed away, so they're very aware of everything that happened, and they were much younger, obviously, at the time, but we don't talk of her as though she's gone. It's just we're waiting to see her again. So they're just very upbeat about it. Sometimes we get sad on, you know, certain days or birthday and stuff like that. But no, they're very confident that she's always with them.
Do you make cookies for her birthday?
No, you know, and I don't make cookies for my kids' birthdays either. They end up getting chocolate chip cookies, maybe, something a little less time-consuming. Right. I'd rather just spend the time with them and not making cookies. Sometimes I will make cookies for them, but they don't really care. They get the extras when I have them, so they're happy with that. Do you remember Natalie?
Yes.
You do? Is she your big sister in heaven?
Yes.
What would be the first thing you would want to do when you get to see Natalie again?
Hug her.
Do you give really good hugs?
Yes.
Yeah, I bet.
So often when a parent loses a child, it can be devastating to the parent. It can ruin a marriage. Did it ever even occur to you that we won't get through this?
In the moment, maybe when it happened, that was a little tough. The first year probably was pretty tough. I had dedicated my life to caring for her, and she needed medicine 3 times a day. She needed feedings through her feeding tube. We went to the doctor all the time, which was fine, and she was a healthy, happy girl, but my life was with her. And so it was hard for me to exist without her. I kind of felt like she was part of my existence. I don't know. And so when she was gone, that was a little tough right away. But she had had so many close calls over the years, and she had been in the hospital and near death a few times with pneumonia. And so we were prepared. You know, this was not a surprise. And actually, it was a wonderful way for her to go because she was not in a hospital on a ventilator or anything like that. She passed away in her home in her bed. And we were just thankful that we had the 10 years with her that we had, because honestly, we didn't think we'd have 10 days with her. The first 10 days of her life were so difficult. And she was flown to Minneapolis, I think the first week, and she stayed a few months there in the ICU. So, I mean, every day we had with her was just, we were just thankful for that. And I talk about it as if it was like this amazing experience. It was tough. It was mentally tough on us as a family. Sometimes I felt like I was, you know, with my other kids, I wasn't giving them the attention that they needed because I was giving so much to her. But they were learning things at the same time about compassion and learning how to care for others. And, you know, I felt good about that. I think our marriage has grown stronger because of it. So, and our family has grown stronger because of it.
Yeah. Where were you able to turn? I know your father-in-law, Jim Olson, is the person who gave me this story idea, and we're very close to his house, even. You have family in town. It sounds like you have a strong faith.
Yes, we have a very close family, so they've helped us over the years. Our family has always been there for us whenever she has gone to the hospital. And there were 3 months I lived in Fargo when she was in the ICU there. And so my kids were taken care of by the grandparents and whoever could. I'm always thankful for that, but it's mainly our faith. You know, I just really, with Natalie, she's just an angel. She has given us so many blessings over the years, and she continues to bless us. And I just, you know, I'm just thankful that she's waiting there for us, the saint watching over us.
What will be the first thing you do when you get to see her again?
Gosh, I just want to hear her voice, because she could not speak. I would love to hear her voice. I just want to listen. That's really all I want to do is listen to her.
She liked the noise that I made when I cried when I was a baby.
She did?
That sounds like she was a really sweet older sister if she likes little sister crying.
Yes.
Yeah.
You must feel really protected to have an angel big sister.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you talk to her?
Yes.
What do you say?
Love you, Natalie.
Love you, Natalie. Did you know that she was going to have cerebral palsy? Is that something they can diagnose in the womb?
No, it wasn't in the womb. She was born early, and that can cause problems. So she had brain bleeds after birth. So usually at 28 weeks, they're pretty good. They have a good run through the ICU, but not us. We've always gone against all of the percentages. Whenever they would say, oh, don't worry about this, this never happens, we would always be the one exception to the case. So at 28 weeks, that's usually a pretty far along. So, you know, she'll probably have some ups and downs, but they usually make it out. So, but no, we had a very long, along the way, there's always been, well, it never really happens that, you know, she'll get over this pneumonia. It never really happens that, you know, she'd have to go to Fargo to, you know, so stuff like that. It was just like, don't ever tell us it can't happen because it will for us then. So,
oh, yikes.
But that's okay. It's part of our life story. And
I presume you have every intention of keeping 9 sticks of butter going in the new house.
Oh, yes. And that's kind of part of the reason we're moving. Well, I mean, we've wanted to get a little bigger space too. But, you know, as we were looking for houses, it's nice that with the cottage food laws in North Dakota, people can make things from their home and sell things from their home without needing to be checked by the state health department. And it's just like it's a nice thing because I would rather have someone I know and trust making something for me rather than, you know, some mass-produced thing from a grocery store. That's just me. Mm-hmm. And so it's nice that you can do stuff like that from your home where I don't have to purchase or rent a commercial space and purchase all of the equipment for it. And if I want to quit, I can quit. I don't have to sell off anything. I just have all my stuff. And if I want to stop and start again, I sure can. But in the new place, I will have a room just for my cookie making. And, you know, at some point, I really hope to do cookie making classes. That's always been kind of a goal for me. And a lot of people have asked for that.
Are there limitations to what you can do with that icing? Like, if I ordered a Sesame Street character, that seems fairly straightforward and, you know, doable. But if I was trying to order the Mona Lisa or something.
Well, I have done Monets. No, okay. No, for my sister-in-law, she likes Monets. Royal icing is such a great medium for making stuff because you can make florals. You can do a plain canvas of white and then use the food coloring to paint on it. And so that's, if you look through my Instagram feed, you'll see some of those I've used before. And I really love that. But no, you can do anything. It's really the sky is the limit. And so when people ask for a certain theme, I just start thinking. And I say it takes 6 to 12 hours to make these cookies, but it's more than that because once someone puts in an order, I have to come up with the designs. And then I really try to stay away from what someone else has done. So I'm trying to do my own thing. So I come up with the designs. And I have to order cookie cutters for it. And I just have to make sure that I have everything that I need that, you know. So that goes into it, all of the back and forth between the people and getting the payments and stuff like that. I mean, it's a really, you spend a lot of time on 24 cookies.
Yeah.
And then after they're done, packaging them up and delivering or pick up. And so, yeah, it's a long process, but it's really gratifying. And it's so much fun to share this with others because it's something fun to see in your Instagram feed for sure.
How many cookie cutters do you own?
Oh my goodness. I don't even know. I mean, it's probably in the 1,000 range. I don't know. Yeah, I know. That seems crazy, but I have two big... I'm packing my house up right now, and I have two huge boxes full of cookie cutters. But they're, you know, one thing I really love about this, from start to finish, I really only interact with small businesses along the way. The cookie cutters are women across the country who have companies where they use 3D printers and they create these cookie cutters. And so I buy those from them. I buy the cellophane bags from them. They have a lot of the decorating tools and stuff like that. Every little tool that I need along the way seems to be from just women who are doing this as a side job. And I really appreciate that we're all kind of supporting each other. So, yeah.
That's a very special community to join.
It is. It's fun to be a part of something where everyone's creative and holding each other up and not comparing. I mean, it's easy to compare yourself to someone who's been doing it for 10 years if you're just starting, but being creative and sharing that with others and, you know, high-fiving each other online and saying, great job, I hope to be as great as you someday, you know, that's really great. You know, the days can be long, especially when you're a mom at home and you're trying to find a creative outlet and doing something like this. So it's nice to hold each other up and say, look, you're doing something great.
Do non-moms have any understanding of how much that outlet matters?
I don't know. Yeah. And there are some women who don't have kids who do this and they can do it all day. I'm like, oh, man, you know, I 2 to 3 orders per week is max and that's, you know, tops. But I just want to sit down and decorate a cookie. So maybe someday I'll hire a secretary.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for being here. This was fun.
That was Melissa Olson, who started 9 Sticks of Butter Cookies to honor her late daughter, Natalie. You can find 9 Sticks of Butter Cookies on Facebook and on Instagram.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, introducing the North Dakota recipients of the 2021 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2021 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
While stuck at home, Roman Mars has been enjoying taking a closer look at the design of the city where he lives.
Use that same eye around the mundane things that you tend to miss in your own neighborhood.
While Paul Theroux gets inspired to write at the beach near his home on Oahu's North Shore.
I'm 80 years old. I don't feel 80 when I'm in the water.
Get a better view of your world on Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
Still to come on Main Street, we have a couple of regulars hearing from Tom Ezern and Chuck Laura. And a lot of people go to Devil's Lake for fishing, but how about for seeing elk and bison? That's all after this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Minnesota Republican state lawmakers want to void penalties for Minnesota businesses that ignored closure orders during the pandemic. Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka wants to take up the issue in the upcoming special session. He wants to give amnesty for rule breakers. Some were fined. Some had licenses pulled. Like Gazelka says, it would help heal divisions.
Now that we're through it, if we really want to get back to normal, I think waiving those penalties is a good gesture to say we're through it. It was hard. We disagree with some of the decisions, but we're through it. And that's, you know, the end goal is everybody is glad we're through it.
DFL officials, including Attorney General Keith Ellison, say letting the relatively few businesses that operated illegally go unpunished would be unfair to those that follow the rules. Parts of the Midwest and the High Plains remain deep into a drought, and as Harvest Public Media's Kate Pikus reports, recent rains aren't enough to remedy the situation.
Parts of the Midwest are in abnormally dry to severe drought. The High Plains are faring worse, with pockets of exceptional drought. Dennis Toddy with the USDA Midwest Climate Hub says even with the May rains, there just isn't enough moisture in the soil for plants to thrive.
We are at greater risk of having problems with crops and other plants as the season goes along because there's not as much moisture available for the crop to be able to grow.
And Toddy says long-term drought could also create problems for water quality. In Iowa, the amount of water flowing into the Raccoon River is just 25% of normal. The state's largest water utility in Des Moines says it's not suffering any consequences, but is watching the situation carefully. Katie Pikus, Harvest Public Media.
And despite several challenges, the regional economy, including North Dakota's, is booming. Dr. Ernie Goss conducts the monthly Business Conditions Index, a survey of regional supply managers in the Midwest. North Dakota's reading on the index in May rose to 75.2, up from its April reading of 74.3. Any reading above 50 indicates economic growth. Goss says while the economy is surging, there are some flies in the ointment, including a shortage of workers and supply bottlenecks across all economic sectors. One challenge, he says, is hitting economy-wide is the hunt for qualified workers, though he does say employees who are coming back to work are being compensated well. Goss says he expects interest rates to stay low for the summer, but by the end of the year, that may change.
Long-term interest rates, we're likely to see those move higher, but the Federal Reserve is what we call monetizing the debt. In other words, they're out there buying bonds, keeping rates low. That's long-term rates low. So some of this is artificial. So we're looking at long interest rates heading forward. So now is the time to borrow, whether you're a business, a family, or an individual. Now is the time to borrow. Rates are probably not going to be this low, this certainly later on this year.
Goss says he also expects the majority of schools to be open in the fall with face-to-face learning, which is also supportive of parents in the labor force. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Volcanoes create and destroy at the same time. Fire can be similar. It isn't all bad. In this week's Natural North Dakota, biologist Chuck Laura talks about the good things that come from prescribed burns.
Many of you probably heard the news about the wildfires in the Badlands earlier this spring. Areas around Medora, the north unit of Theodore Roosevelt National Park, and some other areas have burned. In all, a few thousand acres of native prairie were blackened. We tend to think of fires, whether in a prairie or a forest fire, as destructive. But we need to realize that fire was a natural factor in grassland formation and maintenance. And once a fire started to spread, in some cases it could have gone miles before stopping. Plus, Native Americans burned prairie. A lot of prairie. They were conducted for a variety of reasons, one of which was to attract the bison. Native Americans learned early on that bison were attracted to the regrowth, because it was more palatable, nutritious, and accessible. Burning is a tool in the toolbox for present-day natural resource managers as well. These burns used to be called controlled burns, but they weren't always controlled. Plus, the burns didn't always accomplish the objective. So now prescribed burns are the currently accepted management tool for natural resource managers. Much as a doctor would prescribe a particular treatment for a particular condition, managers do something similar with prescribed burning. If, for example, the risk for a wildfire is high on a tract of land, a prescription would be constructed for conducting the burn. The prescription would contain a prescribed set of conditions under which the burn would be conducted to help ensure the objective is met. Those prescribed conditions would include a specific range of temperature, humidity, wind speed and direction, whether to burn in the wind or with the wind, crew size, etc. On a given day, the burn would be postponed if the conditions of the prescription were not met. Prescribed burning can help managers achieve a variety of objectives. They can, for example, be used to increase the production as well as flowering and seed production of many grassland species. They can also be used to kill or suppress invasive plants such as Kentucky bluegrass and smooth brome, encourage desirable species, or increase habitat suitability for wildlife. If you can view an area where a prescribed burn has been conducted, make a point of observing it. Walk it if you can. Assuming we get some much-needed rain, I think you'll be surprised at what you see. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
On Extra Life, a short history of living longer.
We reveal how changing our behavior became one of the most powerful tools in the fight for extra life.
We are surprisingly able, making changes to our lives.
Watch Extra Life tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. As school is over or winding down, depending on where you live, it's time to think about summer vacation. We are going to go on a tour of White Horse Hill National Game Preserve outside of Devil's Lake with Colleen Grau, who is the Visitor Services Manager with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And where are we?
We are at White Horse Hill National Game Preserve. It is a national wildlife refuge just south of Devil's Lake. It was established as a national park in 1904 by Teddy Roosevelt. It was later transferred to the Fish and Wildlife Service and became a big game preserve for Rocky Mountain elk and American bison in 1921.
And how common are those animals here?
Well, we have a fenced herd, so they're here all the time. Obviously, we don't have any free-roaming bison. We have an auto tour route that is open during the summer months. We close it during the winter because the area is kind of hilly compared to what people would expect in North Dakota. They expect open prairie and flat. We are a lot of hills and a lot of woodlands, actually.
What is your favorite part of this preserve?
Oh, I think our volunteers and our visitors are really what bring this place to life. The bison are here, the elk are here, and the gates are open 8 a.m. to sunset every day, year-round. So we have people coming in. Like I said, the auto tour route is closed part of the time, but they can always access the trail up to, or the road up to the visitor center and the hiking trails that are accessible outside of the wildlife area. Mm-hmm. And so those get used year-round. We have snowshoeing in the winter. We have students coming here for classes in the winter. So even though sometimes the visitor center isn't open, people are out here. Like today, the visitor center is not open, still due to COVID. But I pulled into the parking lot today, and there's 8 cars there, and I ran into a few people I knew.
Yeah. How many visitors in a year, usually?
So we have a car counter at the entrance. There is only one way in and one way out. And so we have a pretty good count on that. And it's about 70,000 visits a year. You know, many people from the area come back multiple times. But we do get, we have a register in the visitor center when people come in that we have people sign in. And we often have, it's usually a challenge to see, do we get one from every state? And some years it's almost every state, 40 to 50 states. And then up to 11 countries as well.
How about bird species here?
Oh boy, there are lots of them. You know, we walk down the middle of migration and it is loud out here with birds. We have recorded over 200 species of birds that have frequented, and we have a list available in the visitor center of those birds that have been seen. And then they're listed as whether they stay here and nest or whether they're rare or migrants or that sort of thing. So in addition to being a big game preserve, a national game preserve, we are also part of the National Wildlife Refuge System, and we are identified as a migratory bird refuge.
And so what does that mean? This is just somewhere where they would naturally have a migratory pattern, or is there something that you're allowed to do to sort of attract them?
Right. So I think the habitat itself attracts them. And most of the refuges in North Dakota are set aside for migratory birds. Mm-hmm. I think the primary reason at one time was waterfowl, but we've learned that while we manage habitat primarily for waterfowl, we are also benefiting a lot of the grassland species. Mm-hmm. White Horse Hill is a little bit unique where we have, there's only 2% of North Dakota that is woodlands. Mm-hmm. And here we are with that woodland area, so it's pretty unique that we get a lot of variety of species coming through.
What is a good habitat for migratory birds? I mean, you just mentioned that there's water and there are woods. Is there anything else?
Oh, goodness. I think anything. There are so many different species of birds. Some favor the water, some favor the grasslands, and some favor the trees. So what makes it good? I think just being in, part of the flyway, and if the populations are high. There are 4 different flyways across the United States. And we are in the central flyway. So as long as their habitat is successfully managed, across the United States and also into Canada. And that's really what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does. Mm-hmm. Whereas you have your state game and fish programs, and they manage a lot of the resident wildlife. Well, Fish and Wildlife manages the migratory wildlife.
And what is successful management? What does that mean?
Really providing habitat across the landscape. The Fish and Wildlife Service has a wetland easement program. Sometimes that's not as well liked by landowners because it is where we have some of the rights to the water resources that are on private lands that they have been compensated for in the past. But it's keeping a continuum of habitat from their wintering grounds to their breeding grounds, wherever that might be.
And you mentioned that this is, of course, fenced in because with big game, you know, you don't want them just running into Devil's Lake or what have you. How do you make sure to kind of maintain the health of a breed where they wouldn't encounter genetic diversity?
Oh, sure, because we're fenced in and we have a very small population. I am the only permanent staff at White Horse Hill. It is a 1,600-acre refuge, but we have, I am also part of a wetland management district, and that district is managed out of Devil's Lake, North Dakota. There are several staff there. It fluctuates anywhere from 10 to 15, depending on the season. And we have a wildlife biologist who looks over the herds at White Horse Hill. We also have, the Fish and Wildlife Service has a bison veterinarian, or large animal veterinarian, which is, and she is stationed in Lewistown, Montana, but she oversees the health of all of the herds that are managed by the Fish and Wildlife Service. The Fish and Wildlife Service manages about 500,000 bison across the United States as a conservation herd.
Recently, there was a name change. I was here a few years ago, and at that point, it was known as Sully's Hill.
That's correct. And I think it's been known as Sully's Hill probably since the very beginning. 1904, like I said, is when it was, I believe it was named as Sully's Hill National Park. It held that name up until December of 2019. Mm-hmm. Senator Kramer passed a bill on behalf of the tribe here at Spirit Lake Nation to rename this to White Horse Hill, which is the name that a late elder, Demas McDonald, had brought forward to the tribe with a story of a white horse that used to roam the hills here when he was raised by his grandparents. Mm-hmm. The name Sully's Hill, it was named after a general in the American Indian Wars. And so being that we are within the boundaries of the Spirit Lake Reservation, we felt that it was necessary and reasonable to change the name to what the tribe had asked.
Yeah. What does that say, do you think, about our cultural understanding these days?
You know, there's still a lot to be learned. I think there's a lot of names that have changed over time here in North Dakota. I think the fact that we can get those things remedied and changed and just provide us an opportunity to interact and understand each other's cultures, I think just opens a lot of opportunity.
Are there programs here that would be specific to learning from Indigenous people or about the plant medicine of this time or just any kind of natural medicine or the traditions of the people of the Spirit Lake Nation?
We're limited a little bit by the funding that we get for visitor services. And the Fish and Wildlife Service mission is plants, animals, and habitat, unlike like the National Park Service is all about people and conserving historic places. So we're a little bit limited on funding, but we have a nonprofit friends group that is very active in the community. And we have been working to get more of the Native American people serving on that board. We currently have one person on there who is from the Spirit Lake tribe, and that has helped a lot. I've also had several volunteers, also some short-term employees who have worked with me. I've had a couple of elders who I've visited with, and so we try to incorporate that into our programming. You and I walked past the beautiful amphitheater, and we have had some drum and dance programs there from the local musicians, and that is amazing. The way that amphitheater was built and just to amplify the sound that comes out of there is really pretty cool. But there are a lot of people and a lot of resources that I think with some more communication and outreach and potentially some funding that we can reach out to some of our Indigenous folks that are right here at the reservation and get more of that opportunity for the cultural interaction. You'll notice any day that the visitors here, it really is about 50-50, you know, as far as the local visitors. We get a lot of Native American families that drive through just to see the bison.
How has COVID impacted White Horse Hill?
So we have a school program that we were able to continue through this year with the COVID. We followed all of the school regulations. The students come out with their teachers. Unfortunately, right now, we would have the visitor center open on weekends, and we would be opening June 1st. We're still waiting for that green light to go, just to keep our volunteers and our staff, you know, safe. We'll get that from our regional office. We'll get the okay to go, you know, hopefully sooner than later, because here in North Dakota, you know, we've been declining since the first of the year. I think we've kind of got it under control, and I hope that we can open soon so that if we do see a spike later in the summer and we have to close again, that we at least have some sort of a season, something back to normal.
What is, if you had to narrow it down, your favorite time, place, season to be here?
Oh boy, that one's a tough one. You know, when I started out here as the visitor services manager, I thought, oh, we're going to be really busy in the summer and we're going to be really slow in the winter and I'll be, you know, able to catch up on things and plan things. And there is not a slow season. With the school program starting in September, you know, that gets up and going. And then by December, we're offering snowshoeing. Our friends group is very active, like I had mentioned before. And they have snowshoes that they have purchased from grants. And they open the visitor center on weekends for snowshoeing. And the trails get used year round. I would say maybe spring. And maybe that's just because we're in spring right now. And we just talked about the birds. But I've told the students, just stop and listen. When you take time to stop and just, and, you know, embrace nature and listen, it's amazingly loud out here right now with migratory birds. And that will be gone in June. You know, the birds will be done slowing down with their breeding, and a lot of the migratory birds will have moved on to their breeding grounds further north. Yeah. We get the students out here. We have an activity that we call a sound map, and we set them down, 25 kids, and we have them be quiet. Totally quiet. We get some, you know, road traffic noise that we can hear, but we ask them to tune that out, and we can hear a goose right now. And the kids just say, wow. You know, they're fifth graders, and it seems like they've never experienced silence in nature. And granted, it's not quiet. We hear water, we hear wind, we hear birds, but it's a different silent than they've heard in their home.
Where does your mind go when you get to experience nature silence?
You know, I think back to childhood and just memories of being outside. I do a lot of outdoor camping, hunting, fishing, those kind of things. I grew up on a small farm in west central Minnesota. And yeah, just kind of the childhood memories. I think it takes you back to quieter, simpler times when you didn't manage so many things as an adult. You had fewer things to worry about.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I'm glad we got to connect.
That was Colleen Grau of the White Horse Hill National Game Preserve. In addition to being a big game preserve for bison and elk, there's also an adorable prairie dog town. Coming up next, Tom Ezern.
While stuck at home, Roman Mars has been enjoying taking a closer look at the design of the city where he lives.
Use that same eye around the mundane things that you tend to miss in your own neighborhood.
While Paul Theroux gets inspired to write at the beach near his home on Oahu's North Shore.
I'm 80 years old. I don't feel 80 when I'm in the water.
Get a better view of your world on Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. In spring, we hear more birdsong. And lately, we've been enjoying more song from Tom Ezern, as he's been tracing the history of folk song and ballads in his Plains Folk essays. This one is called Marching to Bismarck.
Hurrah, hurrah, the farmers shall be free. Hurrah, hurrah, their freedom now they see. Because the time has come when farmers all agree, and now they'll go marching to Bismarck. Two things stand out in the chorus from 1916 I just sang. First, the tune is familiar. It's Marching Through Georgia, a triumphal battle anthem from late in the Civil War. Political balladeers liked to use melodies from the Civil War because they were familiar, conducive to group singing. Second, the song is clearly aspirational in an optimistic way, because really, when did farmers all agree on anything? With the election of a nonpartisan league majority to the legislature, and Lynn Frazier as governor, though, farmers figured they had come into their own.
I'm back on the subject of the balladeers of the NPL, our great farm movement of the early 20th century. One of them was LaRue Lanterman Shaw, author of Marching to Bismarck. Born in our year of statehood, 1889, to a prosperous country family in Morton County, Shaw attended the University of North Dakota, where he was a big man on campus, active in social and cultural matters. It's interesting historians have failed to note how important the state university was as a networking place for aspiring nonpartisan leaguers. Shaw went home to take up family farm interests and was a real community guy, a director of a cooperative store and of a rural credit union. In the meantime, though, he wrote this pugnacious ballad, Marching to Bismarck. Hurrah, hurrah, all farmers now awake. Hurrah, hurrah, we'll listen to no fake. This is our ultimatum, we're here to eradicate the bosses that used to go to Bismarck. Well, meanwhile, another one of our Norwegian balladeers, Ole Edestad of Balfour, born in Telemark, gave voice to the hatred of nonpartisan leaguers for the old party bosses in The Old Politicians. The nonpartisan leader reports, State Senator Ole Edestad livened up the League Legislative Caucus with a few verses in which he paid his respects to the politicians. He also seems resentful of the agricultural experts at the Ag College trying to tell the farmer how to farm. They have told how the land the moisture would keep if he plowed the same land about 8 inches deep, and when he should harvest, and when he should sow, if much larger crops he wanted to grow. Whereas Edestad and his colleagues declared that the pressing problems of the day were not agronomic, they were systemic. O farmer, so long as you mortgage your days and let someone else control what you raise, just that long you'll be in the middleman's care, and the hayseeds will never be combed from your hair. More about Senator Edestad, who was known for his droll wit, on another day, but meanwhile I'm looking for the backstory of another NPL balladeer, Adam D. Kaler of Velva. The press dubbed this bachelor farmer the poet laureate of the 1916 NPL convention, who filled every gap in proceedings with a lively and irreverent ballad. After that, he drops from my historian's sight until, in 1922, having failed to show up for services at his Methodist church, he is found at home dead, the wording of the report implying death at his own hand. Evidently, he was not a happy balladeer after all.
Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 1st. By the late 1800s, baseball was wildly popular. Every town had a team that competed against neighboring towns for local bragging rights. Women were not about to be left out. They couldn't vote or own property after marriage, but they could play ball. They did it in long skirts and high-button shoes. That was about to change. Amelia Bloomer designed loose, harem-style pants that allowed women more freedom of movement. She designed the style so women could more easily ride bicycles. Her new fashion caught on. Women began wearing bloomers for biking, but also for sports like tennis and baseball. Women's baseball teams first played organized games in 1875.
They were popular with spectators as the teams barnstormed across the country, playing local men's teams. Teams like the Philadelphia Bobbies and the Baltimore Black Sox Colored Girls provided young women with employment, independence, and adventure. Some individual women gained national attention. Beatrice Mitchell signed with the men's minor league team. She struck out both Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. On this date in 1900, the Devil's Lake newspaper announced that the Boston Bloomers were coming to town. The team claimed the title of Champion Lady Baseball Players of the World. That was a title they invented themselves, since there were no organized women's leagues and no championship games. Nevertheless, they were one of the best-known women's teams in the country. On June 13th, the Boston Bloomers were scheduled to play a game against the Devil's Lake men's team. The newspaper noted that the Bloomers traveled in a first-class private palace car and brought everything they needed, including a grandstand with seating for 2,000 spectators. Not everyone was a fan of the female teams. Critics said they broke traditional gender roles, and they warned of dire consequences exercise had for women. The teams fought hard to stress that they were women of good character. The Devil's Lake ad for the Boston Bloomers described them as having ladylike behavior. Many teams advertised that no actresses were allowed. Women's teams began to fade out with the increasing popularity of men's minor leagues, and the last of the Bloomer girls' teams played in 1934. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Some Republican lawmakers want to outright ban or limit schools from teaching critical race theory, which examines U.S. institutions and their role in systemic racism.
Teaching our children that America is evil. We need to end it, and we need to end it now.
But some scholars say that theory is more important now than ever.
Let's not fool ourselves and believe that we are colorblind now, because we are not.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, different species can be good indicators of climate change. We're going to check in with how the Center for Forest Ecology at the University of Minnesota is researching climate change and the impacts on this region's ecosystems. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.